Welcome to the latest Watercolors Aquarium Gallery podcast, brought to you from the Aquarium Rush Studios in downtown Grand Rapids, Michigan. My name is Ben.
I'm Amy.
And I'm Charles.
You know, guys, we went to the two in the zoo, and we did a couple of really cool podcasts about killifish. But there were two. We didn't talk about live bearers.
Never give them enough love.
I know. So I think we should.
Yeah.
But before we do that,
we have to do our shameless plug.
Yay.
I want to say thanks to everyone who's ordered this past month because we've been having a great month selling stuff on watercolorsaquariumgallery.com. But we still got more stuff to sell. So if you're looking for some live plants, we'd love to send some out to you. We also have merch designed by Ben and myself and just aquarium goods that you've heard us talk about on the show. If you're looking for anything else, please feel free to let us know.
Cool stickers and t-shirts and stuff.
Yes.
I love it when I see the staff wearing some of those t-shirts.
Yes, they're so fun. And I am in the process of basically re-adding all of our t-shirts. So there should be new colors, new designs. They discontinued ours, so we had to come up with new ones.
Really?
Yes.
Well, that wasn't very nice of them.
So that means new stuff for you guys.
Sweet.
I had a wonderful moment with the podcast listener about a week ago.
Yeah.
I was out and about doing some errands and I saw someone wearing one of our Episto shirts.
Really?
Yeah. And I just yelled, nerd! And they whip around. And then I was just like, and I don't remember exactly what I did. I think I just did like a hi, and they were like, Charles?
Was it someone you knew or just someone random?
Just some random person.
Wow.
I have no idea who they were. I just, like, we nodded at each other.
Cool.
We just moved on with our lives because we both had things to do, apparently, but it was great.
It was so funny. Wow, guys, we're famous.
Sweet.
Yeah, that was great.
That's fun.
Oh, my goodness.
All right, well, a little wave to that person who Charles just called a nerd.
Yes. I love you so much. Oh, boy.
So, live bearers. we're sticking to New World live bearers for this podcast, right? We decided we're doing that. Because, I mean, a great white shark is a live bear.
Right.
I'm double checking that. I think that's what I did, but there's one thing in here that's newer to me, and I want to be very sure.
Oh, no, I have a big cheat on this list.
You do?
So,
do you have alternates?
No.
No? I have like five alternates. How could you only come up with five?
I came up with the five I knew I wanted to talk about, but after that, I will say, I think it's almost all New World.
Okay.
Well, I guess majority. I think it's three and two.
Teleost fish?
I can't even say that. We'll get there.
We're good.
Yep.
Okay. Right.
I knew it was in the New World, but I was like, is it a Psyllid?
Yes. Well, it doesn't have to be Psyllid.
And yes, it's true, but I'm just saying that, like, no, I'm not just kind of in. I'm like, I'm in.
We're all good.
We're good.
You're good. Okay, good.
No, I'm going to rebel.
You
against
are?
Authority on this one.
Oh, no.
I'm going to go my own way.
I'm going to push back. I'm going to push back hard.
I'm going to do neither of those things.
You just wish you were cool like me?
No.
There are two distinct categories of live-bearing fishes. The ovoviviparous and...
Ovoviviparous?
Yes, and the other one.
Viviparous.
Viviparous. And essentially what that means is... With one of them, it's sort of like people where there's actually...
there's like a pseudo placenta.
Yeah, an exchange of like stuff. Like the mother actually is providing nutrient and things for the developing larva.
And that would be viviparous.
Right. Oviviparous. Am I saying that close to right?
Ovoviviparous.
That's what I said.
Yeah. Ovo, egg.
That means essentially they lay an egg, but they don't really lay an egg.
Yeah.
They have a cavity in their body where the egg develops completely independent of the female fish.
Yes.
Right.
The terms are extra confusing because I think like just regular egg laying is oviparous, right?
Yes.
So it's oviparous or ovoviviparous.
Yeah.
So
oviparous.
Just like what I said.
Is it a stutter?
Yeah. I'm going to interject with like a really weird one, though, not related to this particular podcast at all. The weirdest ovoviviparous for me are Lamiformes sharks. They actually have two uteri. They technically have one, but it's two horns, so functionally two. But they'll hatch sharks internally, and then the sharks in there will like start fighting, and so they only ever give birth to two at a time, and it's the biggest one who managed to kill all of its siblings in
and
each uterus.
Eat them, right?
Yes.
Whoever won the cage match.
Yes. Which is actually like evolutionarily a really cool strategy, because that means they're literally born experienced fighters.
That's true.
Yeah.
For a shark, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good practice.
Crazy. Anyways, sorry.
Well, Amy, or should I say Rebel Amy, what are you starting us off with?
Well, I'll start off nice and easy, and I'll talk about Heterandria primosa.
Well, that's an excellent choice.
That's what I've got at home right now. They're absolutely adorable, and they're a native, which makes them a little extra fun. So pretty much found southern U.S. from North Carolina down to Florida and Louisiana.
Fun little side note. That is the smallest vertebrate in North America.
Yes, and they are teeny, teeny, tiny. Like, if a female gets to an inch, it's a big one.
They're such cool little fish.
I found out a really fun fact while I was doing this research, too. These fish still have their original taxonomic designation. It has not changed since they were described in 1859.
Really?
Yep.
Huh. That almost never happens.
Especially for a live bear.
Yeah, the splitters haven't really done their job.
Yeah, right? Like, it kind of have a little bit of drama in there. But nope, it's been the same.
I think it's a monotypic genus, right?
I believe so. Which I guess makes sense why it wouldn't be reorganized. Right.
It didn't used to be.
No?
And that's a teaser.
Oh, right. We'll get there.
Right, right, right.
These are really adaptable. pHs of 7 to 8 are recommended, and temperatures of 68 to 79 was what I saw, which is a massive range. Basically, if you've got an aquarium, they'll probably fit in it, as long as there's nothing in there that will eat them.
And lots will.
Yes. They don't tend to eat their own babies, but anything else will.
Right.
So just a nice, like even a heavily planted 2.5 would be great for breeding these little teeny fish.
Plenty of room for them. These fish, they don't produce a lot of fry at a time, but they produce them often.
Yeah. It's like they're gestating or whatever you would call that for this. And then they'll only release a couple. So those might have 40 in there, but like 2 or 3 a day or two.
Yeah.
It's really unique.
And compared to their body size, the fry that they release are surprisingly large.
Yeah, I haven't seen any babies from mine yet, but I also have some of those dwarf barbs in there, so I think they'd go pretty quick.
I bet the dwarf barbs have seen some of the babies.
Yeah, I need to get some floating plants in there at least.
That's definitely a fish that absolutely needed to be talked about. That was one of my first favorite live bearers. As soon as I discovered that those fish existed, I needed to have them.
And this is one of those, too, where like they're rare unless you're looking for them.
Where that's a good way to
describe it. You're not going to stumble on these fish at a fish store. Like, basically never. But if you go to a fish club, there's at least one person who has them.
Oh, for sure.
And they'd be happy to give you some extras, I'm sure.
Yep. Yep. You got yours at the 2 in the zoo, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yep. I had to get something.
For sure. Amy, you hit it out of the park with your first one. Good job.
Mm-hmm.
I like it.
Yeah, I'm building up a good rapport now before I get slammed for my later ones.
Break the rules.
Uh-huh.
Oh, boy.
What are you going to start with, Charles?
I'm going to start off with Japan blue lyra tail guppies.
Mm.
Those are the first live bearer I ever worked with myself. It was here in this store, and that's a strain that I worked with for 1.5 years. Holy crap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was backtracking that, and I was really proud of those. That's a strain of fish that looks different than when we started off with them, and I'm really pleased with that. And there are people who pop in out of state sometimes to get some of them. And so that's the live bearer that showed me that live bearers could be fun.
Those are probably the coolest guppies I've seen. The combination of the blue, the lyre tail, and that little eye spot some of them get. They're like peacock guppies. They're amazing.
I was hoping I could set that iSpot, but I never quite get it to set right.
It does seem like a lot of the lyretail guppies end up with these cute little lyretails, and yours don't have cute little lyretails. They've got big, full, beautiful flag-like lyretails.
Yeah.
It's like a long fin guppy that can actually swim.
Yeah, for sure.
They're fun.
Yep. A typical guppy care does not have to be a big tank. They're going to reproduce like crazy. Keeping the strain pure is going to be the challenge. So don't ever mix them with any guppies or Endler's live bears.
Yeah.
They'll get all messed up quick.
Yeah, and you call out the deformities. That's just guppy breeding numero uno. Yeah.
Yeah. You missed that we were doing wild type live bears, huh?
I don't care.
You broke the rules worse than me.
I know. I was just going to go on right for it.
At least mine are all wild types.
Hey, wild could mean wild. You never specified that.
I released 10 of these in Florida. They're wild now. Yo,
don't do that. Jeez.
Somebody else already did.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Ugh. Nope. Just wanted to rebel in that way.
Do you release the rest? Are at least the rest of them wild?
Oh yeah, 1,000%.
Okay, good.
This was me being like, whatever. Like mostly just because nothing else on my list would be something I paid attention to if it wasn't for these guppies. So I was just like, it's definitely cheating, but I'm gonna put them on the list anyways.
You did work hard on those fish. Yeah, so, yeah. Mm-hmm. I'll give it to you. Yeah.
They did establish a love for live bears.
Yeah, you can go back through the podcast. I encourage anyone listening, please do. I love the numbers, but there's a definite like line where pre that I'm just ragging on live bear people, and then suddenly there's like 6 months of silence, and then I'm like, okay, I'm into it.
I feel like this podcast has been a growing experience for you to be forced to care about things you didn't care about.
Yeah.
Plants, live bears.
It just happens.
Cichlids.
Man. Cichlids. That's another big one.
Right. Right. Can't just be a barb guy.
No.
Well, what are you going to start with?
Well, I teased a little bit that Hatterandria used to not be a monotypic genus, and it got split. And I don't know how many times it's been split, but I know Neo-Hatterandria was split off of Hatterandria. And there are 3 species of those, and one of them is my favorite. And not only do we have it downstairs, I finally got it at the 2 in the zoo, but I saw our first fry today.
Yay,
so
babies!
That was very exciting. Mm-hmm. So that's Neo-Hatterandria elegans. The other 2 in the species are Trident tiger and Canna. Trident tiger, from what I have read and talked to live bear people, has never been in the United States, and Canna only twice. So elegans is the one that shows up sometimes. It also is a perfect example of why we like scientific names. So if you Google golden teddy live bear, this shows up. Mm-hmm. But another one shows up too. And of course I was going to write down that one, but I didn't. Yeah, I did. Xenophallus umbratilis shows up as the golden teddy live bear.
Yeah, that's the one that I associate with it.
Yeah, but if you Google Neo-Hatterandria elegans, you'll find common name golden teddy live bear.
Stupid common names.
I know, right? Yeah. So these are teeny little fish. They are actually smaller than Neo-Hatterandria than Hatterandria formosa, but they are technically not in North America. They go right along the border of Panama and Colombia. They're endemic to the Rio Atrato drainage in Coco Antigua departments of northwestern Colombia. The full extent of its range is somewhat unclear. That's going right along the Darien Gap, which is the crazy dense rainforest area that there's actually no road that connects North and South America right along that Darien Gap on that border. So it's not a very well-explored area. But these are adorable little fish.
They are so cute and gorgeous.
Beautiful.
You might need a magnifying glass to really make the most of it.
Yeah.
But they're beautiful.
Yeah. I would be fine with a small group of these in a gallon or two. And 2.5 gallons is what, when I had them 10 years ago or so, 15 years ago or so, I bred them just in a 2.5 gallon tank with Nias grass. Right now they're here in a 10 gallon tank with a filter and a heater and all that good fun stuff. I think I could use a little more Nias grass. I might put some more into there. They do like the pH up a little bit. They do come from limestone type rivers, so the pH is up a little bit. And they like it a little bit warmer. So we've got it right about 80 degrees. And as soon as we bumped it up, we had them at about 72, 73 degrees. We bumped it up to 80 and suddenly our fry showed up. And the activity level of the fish just like went crazy.
Oh, cool.
This is definitely a fish that I would put in my all-time favorite fish, like top five all-time favorite fish category. Not far behind my little clown Killies.
Be a pretty good combo too, probably, if you were like... Nano tank.
That's true.
Nano community tank.
See, you keep tempting me with these tank ideas, and maybe one of these days I'll actually do it. We'll see.
You just gotta pop whatever you want in Luann's tank.
Oh, that's a good idea.
She's got a perfect little 6 gallon in back there.
That's true. So Amy is referencing our office manager Luann, who did not come to us as a fish person at all, but she's the one who, you know, makes sure we don't spend too much money and stuff like that. And I told her when she started 8 years ago. That she should have a fish tank on her desk. And so she did, and it's this great little planted tank on her desk. Actually, it's on her filing cabinet behind her desk. But right now she has no fish in it, just beautiful plants. So
yeah, I think she added like 6 chili rasboras when she set it up 5 years ago and just kind of, whatever. I just like to look at the plants.
Yeah, they worked for a while and then they were just, you know.
I think they aged out, honestly.
I think you're right. Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah.
Yep.
I love that tank.
Yep. It's a fun little tank. Fish number two, Amy.
All right. Fish number two, I'm going to go with Limia tridens. Definitely one of my favorite regulars around here, but when I went to go look for more information, I could not find a lot. I was really surprised. But this is one of the few fish that, like, most fish, you look up pictures and you've got to like, okay, let me dial back the saturation 50% and maybe that's kind of what they look like. I have not seen a single picture that does this fish justice. The blue that they can get, not just the speckles of blue, but like a good almost solid blue iridescence is gorgeous.
They're a beautiful little fish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The whole Limia group has some surprising little fish in it, and tridens is for sure one of the top.
Yeah, from what I understood looking, Limia is almost like a catch-all where it's stuff right. That doesn't really fit in anything else.
They're kind of scattered throughout the Caribbean and Eastern Central America. Mm-hmm. There's one that's endemic to Cuba, and there's one that's endemic to Jamaica. And whether those two fish are actually related or not, maybe someday they'll figure it out.
Exactly. But it doesn't do the genus justice because I think a lot of the times they just get painted with this sort of boring, aggressive fish brush. But
True. These
ones are, they're going to get about 1.5 inches at the absolute max. They're relatively peaceful. They're beautiful. They do just fine in a community. Specifically, these are from like Haiti, Dominican Republic Island. But other than keep them hot, that was pretty much all I could find.
They're not going to need much more than that. I mean, they can take some abuse for sure.
Yeah. But I was surprised to see the temp recommended at like 75 to 84, which might explain why we haven't really had too many babies around here, keeping them in like mid-70s.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. One of the things about wild type live bearers that, and it's the reason that they're so understudied, they don't have commercial value and they don't have as much hobbyist value,
mm-hmm.
right? They're not typical aquarium fish. They don't have the broad appeal that a lot of the tetras or a lot of the barbs or a lot of the cichlids have. They're really specialty fish and they reproduce slower. So they're not only the ones that are going to get that appeal are going to end up in the distributors. They don't have the bold colors of the killifish. Mm-hmm. So there's not all that interest in studying them. You got to go to specialty groups for them.
Yeah, it's definitely a hobbyist group.
Right.
For
right.
sure.
Yep. Yeah. So find them. Limia tridens would be a great like gateway fish into wild type live bearers because they're easy and cool.
Yep. Your perfect 10 gallon live bearer, breed a colony, sell them back to the fish store type of thing.
For sure. Mm-hmm. Or bring them to your local club.
Yeah, absolutely. What's next?
I'm going to try and pronounce this Belenus sox, Belenus zanus.
Yeah, those are cool.
That's a pike top minnow. It's basically a Psyllid that is a pike. The males are typically like 4 inches. The females get a little bit bigger. From what I've read, they seem to be very similar to the,
the peppermint pikehead.
Yeah. They seem to be very similar to those in that a lot of the literature says they'll only take live food, but there are some people that are like, yeah, you can definitely graduate them on the frozen food. It does take some work. That said, given their size and their temperament, I think you're probably looking at like a 33 long or something like that. And they do prefer harder water. They are a Psylliid. And they are a live bearer.
Yes.
Apparently, broods up to 100.
They're prolific fish.
Wow.
Yeah.
Getting them off of live food is tricky. But, you know, for the live bearer people, a lot of them consider it like the ultimate culling fish.
Fair.
Like, you want to keep your guppy strain pure, and you want to have somebody next door to them making sure they behave, Bolana Sox is a good choice.
We talk about that enough. We should do a top 5 cull fish.
I think that's a good idea.
Top 5 big mouths.
You're going to write that one down, Amy. That's a really good
put
idea.
Put it on the list. 5 big mouths.
Mm-hmm. I've seen Bolana Sox in clubs a couple of different times. I don't think we've ever had one here.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever
Not
seen it.
Not the entire
it.
Time I've been here.
Yeah. But through live bear conventions and a couple of times they showed up at the local club. And they are just they look mean.
Yeah, they look so angry.
Yeah.
Until you start calling them baloney socks and then it's not as intimidating.
Oh no, right. You're trying to bully a fish into being less predatory.
Uh-huh.
It's the way the live bearer people, like if they're at conventions and there are cichlid people, it's the way they shut cichlid people up. Oh yeah? Oh, you live bears, though, you little wimpy little fish. Oh, yeah, I have Bolana socks. Oh.
Nom, 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 nom.
Yeah, they're ferocious. The pike carassin is the tetra version. And then the peppermint pikehead would be the anabantoid version. And then Bolana socks would be the live bear version.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
Where just one of them decided, you know what? I don't want to be a wimpy little fish. I'm going to grow teeth.
I'm going to become the problem.
Right. Yeah, I like it. That's a good choice. Those are really cool fish.
Yeah.
I thought I'd go with Micropsylia picta.
That's one of my 5.
Is it?
That's okay, though.
Kay.
I can come up with an alternative. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I have lots of alternatives, but that's okay. I'm still going to keep on mine. Swamp guppy is one of the funnest common names for Micropsylia picta.
Yes.
I thought that was a good one. They found from fresh to brackish water. There's actually even some people that talk about full salt as being just fine for Micropsylia picta. In fact, I think that's one of the big issues that people have with this fish. Some people consider it a fairly difficult fish, and I think it really does want some salt in the water. Like it kind of needs that.
Yeah, I would expect maybe with our local high pH, harder water, maybe we're a little bit like in that sweet spot where we can get away with fresh. Because it seems like the club has had some really good success with this fish.
It always goes up and down. It never sticks around for very long.
Interesting.
For multiple generations. And I think that that's why. I think the salt needs to be in the water. This fish, I think, would be a really cool candidate for a macroalgae tank.
Ooh, that would be fun.
The scarlet live bearer is the other name for this fish. And for good reason. They're gorgeous. When those males are mature and colorful and happy, they're beautiful little fish.
Although there are like a good number of color variations too. So maybe that does have something to do with it as well. Like which variation you get, where it's collected.
True.
Like I did see something that suggested that like the color variations are dependent on collection location, not just kind of like mixed in like Pare is.
Right.
So maybe there's a little more we need to know there.
That's probably true.
I don't know.
Yeah.
The red is definitely the most common though, right?
Right. Yeah. And that's the one that actually some of the wholesalers picked those up for a little while. They are found on pretty much northern South America. All along the northern edge of South America, with Trinidad and Tobago as being like that's their common place. There is some back and forth as to whether or not Micropsylia is an actual genus or just a subgenus of Psylia. I tend to side with the splitters, so I like calling it a separate genus, but...
Micropostilia is a great name, too.
It is, right? Yeah, it's a cool name. And it just doesn't look like a molly, so it can't be related.
That's right.
Oh boy. I love getting looks like that from Charles. It's so much fun.
It's just too easy. Yeah.
Solid argument, I guess.
Yeah. 10-gallon tank would be fine. Like I said, some salt in the water would help. Hard water is good, but you know, salt and hard water tend to, with some fish, are surprisingly interchangeable. Plants that can handle that hard water and some of that salt. And like I said, I think, imagine these guys with a big group of just Cato. Mm-hmm. They breathe like crazy.
Yeah. I cannot believe really people haven't caught on to Cato more. It can grow anywhere. Like, oh, yeah. That stuff's crazy.
Yeah. I had to talk about them. I think they're really cool fish. Sorry I took one of yours. Not sorry.
No, that's okay.
Sorry, not sorry.
I remembered a different one while we were talking that I do kind of want to talk about. So, yeah, we'll get there.
Okay.
But I'll talk about one of my cheats next. Are you done with the picta?
Yeah, I think we covered it.
All right. Well, I guess this is a cheat because they're found pretty widespread throughout South and Southeast Asia. I wanted to talk about half beaks.
Cool. Yep. That was the one group of fish that I would have said, all right, that
yep.
tends to be typically associated with the rest of the live bearers. So.
Yeah. So I chose the wrestling. I think it's the most common, probably the one you're more likely to find. And that's Dermogenes pusilla. Gonna get 2 to 3 inches depending on if it's a male or female, mid to high 70s, higher pH range, like a lot of the live bearers. The main consideration I think with wrestling half beaks particularly is male on male aggression.
Right.
So if you're trying to breed them in a small tank and you have two males, they're going to fight. One of them's probably going to kill the other one. But doing like a male and 2 or 3 females seems to be about what most people are doing. If they don't do a bigger tank with a mixed group.
A lot of the hardcore half beak people will talk about letting some algae grow on the sides of the glass. Mm. Because one of the issues with half beaks is them damaging their lower beak. Mm. These are long, skinny fish, and long, skinny fish tend to be fast.
Yeah.
And if they get startled, they can dart into that glass and damage their lower beak. Whereas if there's algae growing there, it'll look like a wall instead of this clear thing that they can swim through.
Yeah, or a reflection of another male half beak or something. Yeah. Yeah. They are supposed to be a little bit harder to breed. People seem to report a lot of like stillbirths or births that don't really work out.
They are a touchier fish than a lot of the Pisiliids or even Gadeids.
Yeah. I've heard that it has something to do with nutrition, but I didn't see anything that said, like, this is the solution for that.
Right. They're a good candidate for insect foods. So bug bites from fluval would be good. Frozen Daphnia, live Daphnia marina is really a great choice for these fish.
But I also don't see a lot of people trying them either. So it could be that we just need to know a little bit more, need a little bit more people going after them.
Yeah, I think that's true.
I mean, this is just one of the great nano oddballs for me, and you know that's definitely stretching the definition of nano, but when most oddball fish are like Bashirs,
right,
this is like you get something really weird and you can put it in a 20 gallon tank. There you go.
Yeah, I agree.
yeah
those are really cool fish. All right, Charles, what's next?
I'm gonna talk about the tequila splitfin.
Oh yeah. Ooh. Those are cool.
So this is the only Gadeid that made my list, unless I need to start throwing in alternates. But I wanted to talk about this one because it's kind of the one example of the hobby being really pulling through and reintroducing like a fish back into the wild.
That's right.
And it's a really weird story in the sense that like there are so many circumstances that had to work out in order for this to happen. They spent years like just growing them in vats outside just to make sure that they like were sustainable as like little populations. They spent a lot of time making sure that they didn't have any diseases and parasites and stuff like that, because you don't want to introduce something new into the wild. And they also tend to come from habitats where they're the only thing in that particular like pool. And yeah, so like the risk of them like cross-contaminated or getting knocked out is less so. So like there's fewer variables. And so it's something that I want to talk about and think about and people look into because, A, it's a really cool story. I don't know all the details off the top of my head because there was so much involved to pull this off.
Oh, yeah.
There was like four different Gadiad groups, like all these international collaboration. Because this is predominantly at the time, I think, British and American hobbyists releasing fish into Mexican waters.
Yeah.
You know how much jurisdiction that is?
Oh,
that's
yeah.
absolutely insane.
And wanting to do it like super right and super legit.
Yeah. And man, just the amount of collaboration it took to do that. So everyone needs to like go look this up because it's absolutely insane. But also think about the fact that like that's how much work it took. Like something like this, that's the easiest way. Like that, all the variables for doing that, the circumstances in this species are the easiest it could have been. And that's the part that I always want to temper with where people are like, look what we can do. And I'm like, yeah, look what we can do when it's easy.
Right.
The, like, we didn't have to fix the habitat. We didn't have to, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like
mm-hmm.
we did, but like not,
it was a fixable small habitat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not like an entire stream ecosystem with like tributaries and stuff. It's different. And so like, that's my, like, this is the species I wanted to talk about because I'm like, this is the story of how to do it, but also the story of like, okay, but don't forget the value of maintaining these habitats in the wild because like we were able to turn around with this. We won't be able to with a lot of these other ones.
Right. Right. The coordination with getting that habitat so it could actually hold these fish again, because this was a fish that went extinct in the wild because the habitat was completely polluted and destroyed.
Yeah. And the level of like precision that had to be involved in this, like they put markers on different batches of fish so that they could go back and like sample them. Mm-hmm. So like they can say that fish from batch one did really well. Fish from batch two did not do so well. And they had to go back and be like, all right, what did we do different when we were raising this fish so they didn't do as well? Like, was it batch one, batch two? No, I'm just using it as examples. But yeah. They have had to do that where, like, certain release numbers didn't, like, batches didn't do well. And why? What changed? What did we do different?
Yeah. Yeah. Science without documentation is just what?
Beep.
Do you want the friendly version?
This is such a great example of, so every hobbyist out there, when they take on a care species or take on a fish that they know is threatened or endangered in the wild or extinct in the wild, has this little pipe dream of maybe my fish will get reintroduced someday. And they won't, right?
Yeah.
That will never happen. Now, that doesn't mean don't maintain the species because it is still the only place that that species exists. But this is the one time when it actually did happen.
And we should appreciate that.
Yeah, yes. And it's proof that it can happen. That, right. to me, is that big, like, the hope that at some point the aquarium hobby can work with science and not reject it.
With science and with politicians.
Mm-hmm. And with each other.
With each and other. And, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and, like, Tequila Spitfins had a very specific, like, they came from a native population that was very small. So like the amount of like genetic drift we could do on them in captivity was already pretty low.
That helps.
And so like they, like this was a fish tailor made for this sort of project. Like one of the things I was talking about with Calder recently was like, how quickly do we have to say that the stuff we keep in tanks is not the same thing as in the wild?
Yeah.
Because like, how we breed is different. The habitats we're keeping them in are different. Like people talk about how easy F2 fish are to keep compared to like wild caught and F1s. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yeah, because they're already evolving to the environment that they're reproducing in. And they have a massive bottleneck. So there's a massive evolutionary incentive to quote unquote figure it out. Like when you're only breeding two fish out of like 5,000.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, and you know, I was trying to figure out just how to say this right. Like I was going to say, most of the fry in the wild don't survive. No, that's not right. Almost all of the fry in the wild don't survive. Nope, that's still not enough. None of the fry in the wild, with a few exceptions, survive to reproduce.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's almost the way to say it. And in a captive breeding population, almost all of the fry, with a few exceptions, survive and go on to reproduce. And so
actually,
what that does
I would argue
genetics,
a little differently.
Yeah? Okay.
Yeah. With egg scatterers in particular, like the captive strains of cherry barbs, with some exceptions,
okay,
are almost genetically identical. They have been so selectively bred that and so like a lot of the stuff that we keep in the industry, like hundreds of thousands, if not millions of them are produced every year. Mm-hmm. And then maybe a couple hundred are being bred because most people don't breed.
Oh, sure. And that's all it takes to produce that many fish.
Yeah.
Is a few.
Like think of like 20 years ago, a single pair of maroon clowns could keep the entire eastern seaboard stocked with maroon clownfish.
Oh, easily.
So like, that's a genetic bottleneck if I've ever seen one.
Right.
Like,
yeah, it's like not in the wild, everyone's breeding, but only a few survive. And in captivity, it's only a couple are breeding, but a bunch of them survive.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's an entirely different evolutionary strategy now.
And it's going to change the fish.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now, in the context of this topic,
yes.
Yeah, most people keeping live bears, most of their fish are wild type live bears. Most of their fish are going to reproduce, you know, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. that's the end goal. So, but with most stuff in the hobby, no, it's an entirely different selective pressure. Mm-hmm. It's spooky how fast those things get different now.
This was a really cool reintroduction, and I'm glad it happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the best aquarium stories that you can read about.
Yeah. So my next fish, I'm actually going to introduce by introducing the family. Because the family, this family of fish, and it's one that I suspect at some point it's going to get all like split up. But this whole family of fish are just like crazy unique oddballs among the live bear and not live bearing fish communities.
Mm.
Ooh, thought I'd throw that one in there. How much do you guys know about the family Anableptidae?
Oh yeah.
Never enough.
Right. So there are three genera in the family Anableptidae. And one of them is not a live bearer and two of them are.
Interesting.
In the same family.
Yeah, fish are weird.
Right, right.
Some people might know them as the four eyes.
Right.
I love that name.
Yes. That's the Anableps genus.
Just specifically that genus are
just
the four
eyes? Just that genus. Genensia is also in that family. And those are called the one-sided live bearers because the males either, for lack of a better way to describe it, either swing left or swing right. But,
and the females either catch left or catch right.
So that was actually, it was thought that for a long time, but that myth now has been busted. The females can catch either way.
Okay.
But for a long time, it was thought that the females only could either catch left or catch right. And so if you had a pair of genensia, you had to make sure it was a left swinging male and a right receiving female. And it turns out that's not.
Okay.
That's not a thing.
That makes it a little simpler.
Yeah. The Genensia genus is a little more challenging of a genus to breed. But I'm not talking about Genensia. I'm talking about Anableps.
Okay.
So, but I just wanted to go through how unique this family is and why at some point they're going to get changed. And then the other fish, Oxyzygonectes dovii, is the other fish in that family, and Oxyzygonectes, I'm saying that all kinds of messed up, that's a monotypic genus. So dovii is the only fish in that genus, and that one is typically it's referred to as a killie, but it's an egg layer. It's not a live bird. Yeah.
What a wonky group of fish.
It's a wonky group. You know, I am going to talk about Genensia, not Anableps, because they're all just so cool. But I realize that's what I have the most notes on. So, Genetzia lineata is the one-sided live bearer. Genetzia onca and Genetzia lineata are two fish in that genus that are really, really pretty similar. And these are like a really cool leopard spot live bearer. And they are the one-sided. They are found... Hang on. The Genetzia onca is native to Brazil and Uruguay. And like I said, the males have what's called an asymmetrical gonopodium that either swings or hooks one direction or the other. Yeah, but this is a really, really unique group of fish, and they're a really cool looking group of fish. They get a little bit bigger, so they do need a tank at least a 20 long, if not something a little bit bigger. And they're better off in a little bit of a larger group, and with a fish that's really hard to find, that's one of the big challenges that goes along with them. They reproduce very slowly, sometimes only 2 to 5 fish a month. So from live bearer standpoints, that's little, especially for a fish that can get up to 2, 2.5 inches long. So it's a slow reproducing, really interesting, really unique fish. And then cooler water. They don't want it above 72 degrees. Onca can take it a little bit warmer than lineata. They can get up to 75, but they'd be a good candidate for tanks without heaters. If you can get your hands on them. I've tried them twice, and I kept the adults for, I don't know, I think I had them almost a year.
Okay.
And I got one fry one time.
How are they with food? They look like turkey feeders.
They'll eat just about anything.
Oh, cool.
Feeding was never the issue. Yeah, flake food, Daphnia, frozen food, live food, they'll just devour it.
Yep. Sweet.
Super cool, super unique fish.
So it seems like... hardest part is finding them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But that whole family of fish is just this
crazy, weird stuff.
Weird. And I think it's got to be lumped together. I mean, morphologically, they don't look related. And that's not necessarily a thing or not, right? If you look at a picture of an Anableps and a Genetzia, and that, I cannot say that name correctly. I can't even close to say that name. Oxy. You know what? Google the family Anableptidae, and then you'll find the name of that fish, right? That's the best way, because it's just such a unique, oddball-looking fish.
Hopefully Nick has it in the description.
Right. They're really cool. The leopard pattern on them is really fun and really unique and special.
I'm glad you brought it up. I can't believe it took us this long for the live bear discussion to get awkward.
Oh, boy.
That's well, right. I'll take it there on my next one.
Okay, good. There we go.
Right. Well, I have a fun alternate that popped into my head as we were having this discussion.
Yeah, what's up?
I think this is the first wild type live bear I was exposed to, which is kind of fun because it's like a crazy rare one. Priapicthes nigroventralis. This is one that Pat brought to us at that first ALA.
Oh,
teeny tiny little bright orange live bears. They get about an inch long. But honestly, the notable feature of these is they have one of the highest proportions of gonopodium to body length, where it's an easy 40% of their body.
That's right. And they flick that little thing around like...
It's honestly, these are like the most vibrant little active fish that are just an absolute blast to watch. They do flick it around like a little flag, and you can see it on that inch long fish very, very well.
I remember that. You know, I couldn't think of what fish you were talking about
until you said that.
No, I totally remember them.
If you see the picture, you'll totally recognize it because are just absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, they're gorgeous.
But it is a very notable feature of them.
Yes.
I actually could find almost no information. I was just looking while you guys were downstairs, other than that the gonopodium is about 40% of the length of the body and they come from Colombia. But that was a fun fish to be able to have for a little while.
We kept them here and we got fry.
Yeah.
They were in a 10-gallon tank with probably Java fern or no, probably Nias grass or guppy grass as some people like to call it.
I think we sort of like faded out with them because we tried to add them to a display.
It's all coming back to me now.
Yeah.
Yep.
That was a long, long time ago.
It was.
And a fun little fish.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say that this could be in any tank you would put guppies in.
Yeah, I would say so.
Care, I think it's going to be very, very similar. I don't think they're a cooler water. No, they're a 74 to 78 degrees. Yeah.
Yeah, that's Columbia. Pretty much, and that's just like fish-based information. That was the best I could find from these. There's not even a Seriously Fish page for them.
That's pretty cool. And they're pretty.
They are. Colorful. Yeah, right. For that tiny fish is always fun to see.
I got nervous when you talked about a cool little orange fish, because that's the one that I'm talking about. Sure, oh, looks a lot like it, doesn't it?
It does look
a lot
like
it. It's a different fish. Yeah. Cool. That's a good choice, Amy.
Mm-hmm. And that's all I have on that one. So, yeah. Charles, go ahead.
Xiphophorus clementiae.
Mm. Excellent.
It's one of the southern swordtails. They are kind of cool because they're the wild type live bearer that we have a calling of in the store.
Mm-hmm.
They're the first one that I worked extensively with in any capacity. They don't seem particularly picky.
Treat them like a regular swordtail.
Yeah. Except they do like clean water.
That's true.
And
that's true.
They actually are a little bit more carnivorous than most swordtails, is one of the things I learned when we were researching.
Okay.
Which I think is part of what, like, we have people running around with frozen food every day. And I think that's part of why we were a little more successful with them before some of the other live bears, because we feed a pretty meaty diet around here.
Yeah.
Apparently we do have to do a little shout out to Pat Hartman, because all of a sudden his name just got mentioned twice.
Mm-hmm.
Pat Hartman is one of the coolest geeks I know. He might even use the term nerd, but definitely he would use the term geek. He's a retired chemist who's a fellow of the American Live Bear Association, and just a all around good, fun guy who mm-hmm. likes to bring us funky, crazy live bears and appreciates the fact that we want to try to take some of the funky, crazy live bears he gets his hands on and try and make them a little more mainstream. So thanks, Pat. Anyways, that offers clementiae.
Yeah, I don't know. They're just fun. I also just appreciate them because we've had them here long enough that they're a little like sub lineages of, like, there's a couple people who are breeding them in the Motor City Aquarium Society who originally, like, one guy got some from us, and there's just that connectivity that's cool.
We're sharing the love on that fish.
Yeah.
We're paying it forward because of Pat.
Yeah.
And this is one that has a really lovely tropical fish hobbyist article about it, which is always fun to see where, you know, somebody spent a lot of time with it and are reporting on it.
They're beautiful swordtails. I mean, that's a good looking fish.
Yeah.
Some of the wild type swordtails and platies can get a little bland. Meh.
Yeah.
But I think clementia is one that.
Yeah, that yellow cool. stripe on the sword really stands out.
Yeah, for sure. Yep. Fun choice.
Yeah.
So what was the name of the fish that you?
It was Priapicthes nigra ventralis.
So I showed Amy a picture of Felicthes tico.
That's a cute name.
I know, right? Felicthes tico. So if you want the pretty orange fish that Amy described, but the gonopodium may be a little intimidating, look for Felicthes tico.
We should call it a thingy dingy in honor of Pat.
Right. Yeah, that's definitely Pat Hartman term, is the thingy dingy. Felicthes tico is a similarly sized fish, and similarly colored. I mean, it's an orange fish with a black dorsal fin and a little bit of a yellow in the dorsal fin, which is what your little well-endowed fellow seems to be described as. These are found a little further north. So this is a Central American live bearer, the San Juan River in Costa Rica and up into Nicaragua, upper reaches of the San Juan, actually. A little smaller, 2.5 centimeters for a male, 4.5 centimeters for a female. I guess that's about the same size, right?
Yeah.
4.5 centimeters is basically 2 inches, a little less than 2 inches.
That's a little bigger, I think.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Okay. One of the websites called it this charming little fish.
See that those types of words a lot when you're looking up live bears.
Yeah, for sure.
Charming, dainty.
Like a lot of these wild type live bearers, there's not a commercial fishery for any of these fish. So what happens is people that are really into these little live bearers go to Costa Rica or go to Colombia and physically collect them and bring them back. That's where a lot of these fish end up in the hobby. And Felicthes tico, I've seen go through the clubs. And that means some enthusiastic club member went to Costa Rica, or maybe Nicaragua, most likely Costa Rica.
It's pretty tough to get stuff out of Costa Rica,
though. That's a good point.
Like, they do not want you collecting there.
Yeah, that's true.
Probably started in Costa Rica and drove to Nicaragua.
Yeah. Yeah. It was described as occasionally imported by traveling enthusiasts. There are not many of these fish in the United States, so if you do have them, keep it.
I've never heard of this one.
Yeah, they're beautiful. Water chemistry is not important. Just avoid extremes. pH 7 to 7.5. 7.8 is fine. Hardness isn't a big deal. A little on the warmer side, so 24 to 28 degrees Celsius, which is going to get up to just about 80 degrees. And they readily accept whatever. They do want some plant material in their diet. Great little live bear. Cool little non-xiphophorous, non-swordtail. Doesn't look like a guppy. Doesn't look like a swordtail. Looks like its own little thing.
Yeah. Great choice.
Yeah. They're fun. That's it. That's all I got on that little guy.
Well, I saved my biggest cheat for last because this is not from the New World, nor is it a Telios fish. Because I wanted to talk about rabbit snails, which are ovoviviparous.
Not even a fish.
We just said live bearers when I had the conversation with you.
I guess
you.
It is a wild type live bearer.
It is. Mm-hmm. So rabbit snails are generally going to be of the genus Tylomelania from the lakes of Sulawesi, Lake Matano, Lake Tuwuti, whatever the third one is. Get about 3 inches long, get a berry in the substrate most of the time, go around eating detritus, but they do release a fully formed snail about once or twice a month, typically.
We've Looks seen like, that happen here, and it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Like, wait, hey, look, there's Malaysian live-bearing snails in with our rabbit snails, but they're darker in color.
Mm-hmm.
Wait a second.
And they come out looking like a tiny adult rabbit snail. Like, they've got the color, they've got the little face. They're pretty adorable. They take forever to grow. One of the main issues I think most people have with rabbits, where, like, if you're having trouble with your rabbit snails, if they're not moving, if they're dying, turn up your temperature. They really want it around 85.
85?
Yeah, if not a little warmer.
Wow, I didn't know it was that hot.
Yeah.
I knew it was warmer, but I didn't know it was 85.
I mean, I would definitely get above 80, I think. Not too many people have a tank that can take 85, but yeah. That will give you a lot more activity with your snails. Yeah. Sexing them is impossible, but they do have males and females, so get a big group of rabbit snails and just kind of see what happens.
Let them do their thing.
Yeah. It'd suck if you just got, like, all males and...
No.
But the females can hold sperm just like a lot of snails can. So if you're lucky to get a female, she's probably pregnant, and then you'll be in good shape.
There you go. Perfect. All right. So you didn't cheat as much as I thought. You're fine with that one. That's a great choice. I like it.
Yeah. Close enough.
Yeah.
It's probably less cheating than... Japan blue lyre tail guppy.
Definitely
1,000%. Yeah.
Definitely is.
I thought you were gonna like come up with a stingray or something like that.
Nah, snails are more fun than stingrays.
Yeah, at least in a tank.
Yeah. Yes.
I'm kind of surprised. I mean, that would have been a New World life there.
That's true. Yep, that's true. Wait, is that number five for you?
Yeah, that's the last one.
Wow,
I got one more.
What you got?
I was gonna talk about Xiphophorus nigrensis.
Oh, your new babies.
Yeah.
Very cool.
I'm going to be honest. I don't think this is going to be a long-term project for me, but I'm having a lot of fun with it because I think my goal with it is I want to breed a bunch of it, get a bunch here in the store, have you guys set up a colony, get some colonies with some other people, and then just let it be.
Then just peace out. Did my thing.
Yeah, because what's really cool to me about this fish is it's in the Pygmaeus clade.
Yeah.
It's a tiny swordtail that's blue.
Right.
You know how hard it is to find a small swordtail, let alone a blue one? Mm-hmm. That's a cool fish. That's a fish that should be around in the hobby more. So, honestly, my end goal is to just get it into the hands of people more capable than myself at getting it out there.
Yeah.
And
we could do that.
Yeah. And so I'm like, but I think they're like an inch and a half. Maybe 2 inches if it's a big female.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned blue. They're not too picky about parameters. They do like it a little harder, so they do really well in our tap water here. They seem to like it in the mid-70s, although I was told they do tend to like it a little cooler, which...
a surprising number of the Xiphophorus genus likes it a little cooler.
Yeah, which, hey, if you don't want a heater in your tank, there you go.
A lot of these fish are from mountain streams in Mexico.
Yeah. And so they're fitting in just fine in a, and I would never say this with the standard swordtail, the colony is settling in just fine in a 10-gallon.
Nice. That's cool.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
Yeah. A regular swordtail is kind of a big fish.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
On the scale of what most people are keeping right now.
So I think this fish just has some advantages that, like, it makes itself more accessible to people who might want the swordtail package, but in something that's more manageable
and a little more unique.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's, I think it's important to talk about when we're talking about, and I'll say swords and platies, which is the Xiphophorus genus. We're used to seeing velvet swords and sunset platies and marigold swords and all these kinds of things. If you look at how big the genus Xiphophorus is, there's a lot of really cool fish that you never see.
Right.
Yeah.
They don't get the attention because they don't end up bright red or bright yellow or bright blue or whatever magical color somebody managed to pull out of that fish, but they definitely deserve important places in the hobby.
Yeah.
Well, and this could apply to so many of the fish we've talked about today where they're not going to be beautiful in a fish store.
Right.
So many of those, like even a green swordtail, like the wild type of our typical sword, takes a while to show how pretty it is.
Once they do, they're very cool.
Yeah, I almost put Helleri on my list just because I love the green.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. This is just a fun fish, and I think more people should look into it.
Yeah.
Nice. I can't describe, like, they settled in really nice with an iridescent blue that is just hard to beat. It's cool.
It's actually a really good transition into my last fish, which you said this is just a great little Xiphophorus. So I want to talk about the biggest Xiphophorus.
Oh, please do.
Yeah. The Montezuma sword.
Ooh.
This is if what's the species of your fish? Sorry.
Negrensis.
Okay. If Negrensis is this dainty little blue Xiphophorus species, that's a great cute little fish. The Montezuma sword is this majestic version of a Xiphophorus fist. The length of the sword on a Montezuma is described as, where is that? 3.5 times body length. So on a 2-inch male, you can have a 6-inch sword.
Mm-mm.
That's massive. That's a really, really cool looking fish. They're a little trickier than Xiphophorus helleri, which is the swordtail that we all know about. But it is a stunning fish with the length of that sword. I'm sorry, not three times, twice body length. So a 3-inch fish is going to have a 6-inch sword. Is that what I said? Anyway, we get the idea. Yeah. A little on the cooler side, so 68 to 76. Which, you know, if we say up to 76, that doesn't mean 76 is fine. That means they can get up there. But really, if you're keeping them around 70, 72 degrees, that's going to be better. They do like it on the harder side. So our tap water is fantastic.
Just a reminder, our tap water is like pH of 7.6 and a TDS of like 200.
Thank you. I forget sometimes.
We didn't mention that at all in this episode.
Yeah. pH... temperature, talked about that. This is a big fish, right? So a 40 long is actually the recommended size for Montezuma swords. And when you see adult full-grown Montezuma swords, first of all, you go, oh, that almost doesn't look right. But then you realize, yeah, a 40 long is what you want. But if you do a biotope display with a big group of Montezuma swords, that would be just a stunning display, and watching those males display to each other. And that's what they'll do, is they'll display. They're not going to fight. They're not going to bicker. They're not going to bite their swords off. They're going to show, I'm bigger and prettier. No, I'm bigger and prettier.
Yeah, well, it's sort of like a thread fin rainbow or something. You don't have big, long fins like that if somebody's just going to rip it off every
right.
day.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Right, right. They don't last long that way. Yeah. If the conditions are right, these actually are easy and prolific breeders, but good, clean water with those parameters right is what they're going to require in order for them to be prolific. if you've never seen one of these, at least look at a picture. You can kind of get the idea from a picture with the length of that sword on these fish. When you do finally see one in purpose, holy cow, it just, like I said, it doesn't look right.
This is like the king of the live bearers.
Totally agree.
A total holy grail.
Yep, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Great choice.
I have seen this fish available every time I've been to an ALA convention, and I think I've been to 8 of them. I've never seen it anywhere other than an ALA convention. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely never been on the list.
Yeah. Great well, that pick. Was our 5.
I know. What? We didn't mention a single Molly.
No. A true sailfin Molly. These can be some really big, really cool looking
they
fish.
They are beautiful. Yeah. They're just... Everybody who gets them underestimates how aggressive they are.
True.
And so that makes me hate them.
Right.
But if I saw them in a context where they fit, they would be gorgeous. They are so outgoing. They're really cool.
One of the live bear conventions, somebody had a 55-gallon tank set up with 6 giant sailfin mollies in it, and it looked overcrowded.
I believe it.
Yeah.
It's just not even just like a long fish. It's like
right.
Dense, chunky fish.
Yep. Did you guys have any other alternates? Because let's rapid
not
fire.
Not really.
Those quick.
I mean, we didn't talk about Micropacilia perae.
Yeah.
But it's just basically
those are
picto
cool.
with different colors right. and a little bit more elongate, I guess.
We touched on Anableps, which is a fish that I mean the four-eyed fish is they're a really cool looking fish.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I had Xiphophorus nezihal coyotl as an alternate, mostly because the name is really fun to say.
Fair.
Right. And Xiphophorus birchmani, I had that on my list because it's almost like when you look at Xiphophorus helleri as a part of a complex within the genus Xiphophorus, there's a whole bunch of them that kind of look like that. And if you look at Xiphophorus birchmani, there's a whole bunch of other swordtails that kind of look like that. And Malinche and Nezihal Coyotl are 2 of them that are in that group where they've got some pretty significant vertical barring. So they fit in that genus with being a little bit different. The only other one, and I'm going to save this one for a later podcast because I have some fun stories about Xiphophorus evlinae.
Oh, I don't know that one
at all. It's the Pueblo platy, and I actually won an award for that fish.
Fun.
But nice. I'm saving that story.
Does the Hawaii Variatus count as a wild type?
No. Does not belong. There we go.
I don't know any wild type platies other than sort of that one.
I mean, I know the southern platy, but they're not too crazy looking.
When we're talking about swords and platies, it's the same genus.
Yeah.
And so, and some of the ones that are called platies have a little hint of a sword.
Yeah.
And then they say, no, it's a sword tail because it's got a little like... It's a bottom part of a lyre tail, and so that's enough. Like, actually, Xiphophorus Malinche hardly gets much at all of a sword. I mean, Montezumas are going past that going, really? So I would have to look at the statistics about how many, I don't even know how many species there are in Xiphophorus, but it's quite a few, and about a third of them would be considered platies and the rest
yeah
of the
yeah
sides.
No, there's one where I'm blanking on the scientific name, but there's like one just called the southern platy.
Oh right. Yeah. Variatus maculatus evlinae, and anyway we could play this game all day, but
yeah
there we go. So I think we just kind of barely touched on the live bearer groups, so I think it's definitely a topic that we're going to have to get into in a little bit more detail, kind of go into. We hardly talked about gadeids. We hardly talked
just
about
the one.
Pupfish,
mm-hmm.
Of which there are live-bearing pupfish and there are egg-laying pupfish, but they are, you know, in different groups.
I think the nature of live-bearing makes this whole conversation just inherently a little bit muddy.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, there are groups that seem to produce a lot of diversity really quickly. There's a lot of different variations even among species. There's a lot of things being changed and rerouted. Right. Like, I don't think we talked about any Gambusia.
That's true.
I think that's probably the only genus that I can think of that we just didn't touch on at all.
Oh, there's lots of genera that we didn't touch on.
Mm.
Yeah. There's a lot more genera of live bearers than
yeah.
ever get talked about in the hobby. It's it's a niche group, mm-hmm. and it's a really cool niche group. So it's definitely one that needs some more attention. So we're going to have to give it some more love. This is just, we'll call this almost just a teaser. Some of the live bearer people are going, but you didn't talk about.
Yeah, and you're right. You know, if you're feeling that way, please post your pictures in the Watercolors Aquarium Gallery podcast listeners group. Even if not, we'd just love to see what's going on in your tanks. And if you've got any questions, comments, concerns for us, you can also email podcast@watercolorsaquariumgallery.com. We're always taking questions that we can gather for listener episodes. Those are a blast. The more we get, the more we can do. Go to watercolorsaquariumgallery.com and buy some fun stuff from us. We're always coming out with more.
And as always, thank you so much for listening. Let's have lots of fun and keep those hands wet.